Hare Krishna. I'm in Delhi here at Ankur Prabhu's house, and actually Manjwali and Nishinga Pran are also here. They're leaving tomorrow. They've been here taking cooking courses, specially arranged cooking courses, to improve their cooking skills for Rari Shan and learn different styles of cooking, different types of sweets, and so on. And take that back and both practice it there and then also teach it to other devotees. Let's hope other devotees pick up on it. So, topics yesterday I was discussing that in order to be able to learn how to cook in a certain way, like different types of Indian cooking styles, you have to like that type of food. You can't cook something you don't like. And when, I'm not going to get carried away, I have another subject I'm going to talk about, but this is one of my pet peeves, but when people don't have, or devotees don't really like Indian cooking, and they don't have a real taste for the different exotic flavors of different types of Bengali, Punjabi, Gujarati, Marwari cooking, then even though they may sort of learn them, if they'd rather eat pasta, then sabji and rice and dal, then it's hard. It's hard to really be a good cook. You've got to like what you eat. That's sort of a basic ABC. But today, what I was going to talk about is my love-hate relationship with India. I went up on the roof. It's much cooler here than in Mayapur. Much, much cooler. And it's actually still foggy right now, and it's almost 10 o'clock in the morning. Went up on the roof this morning, and I just sort of looked over the skyline, and I pointed out to Ankur that there wasn't one building out there worth looking at. Others, they were all just horrible. If I was the mayor of Delhi, I'd bulldoze 90% of the whole city. By comparison to some of the other beautiful buildings that exist or existed, a lot of which were actually still from Mughal times. And it's in one sense representative of what's happened to India and what that invokes in quite a few people that I know, this sort of love-hate relationship. Love because India, Indian culture is the remnants of Vedic culture. Vedic culture meaning actually the original culture of the spiritual world. And it's such a Srila Prabhupada's vision was that he even used the word Indian culture, that we would conquer the world with Indian culture, that we would transpose Indian culture to the rest of the world, because Krishna consciousness is not just a religion, but actually a way of life. How to eat, how to sleep, how to entertain, how to sport, everything. And Srila Prabhupada wanted us, wanted that culture to be transplanted to the West. And he saw that Indian culture, in terms of the remnants of the Indian culture, is what best represents that. And of course, Indian culture gave us Srila Prabhupada. From India, we got Krishna took birth in India. Krishna's different incarnations appear here. Now we have the Vedic literatures. And India's the place where Srila Prabhupada brought us in order to convince us that Krishna consciousness was not just a cult, but It was a way of life for many, many people. And while it remains a way of life for many people, in one sense, the general overall effect of Krishna consciousness on the people is not changing their life or lifestyle. Many people are becoming Krishna conscious because more than probably any other place on the planet, Krishna consciousness is more successful in India than elsewhere. We're constantly opening temples. They're distributing more books than anywhere else in the world. Krishna consciousness in India is really a success story, but by comparison to the pace in which India is imitating the West and actually leading the West, because we know that India is actually going to be the economic powerhouse of this decade, who knows, next few decades, maybe the century, unless the world goes into a tailspin, which it well may. And at the rate at which they are trying to be American, look American, European, use the American way of life, commodities. I was just glancing through a luxury magazine, Indian luxury magazine, luxury goods magazine, on the airplane over here, and it was just promoting all the Western luxury goods, and it was its mood was that Western luxury is the way in which Indian newfound wealth should be invested and the nouveau riche should go. And when you just come into the airport and walk around the streets, then you see sights that didn't exist when I first used to come to India almost 40 years ago. Boys and girls walking hand in hand, arm in arm, kissing, girls dressed in jeans, short skirts. These were non-existent in days gone by. They really didn't exist. The momentum of exploiting India's resources, how the road between Delhi and Mathura has built up into factories, how it's really visible, for instance, it's really visible in the Dam, which has become more a tourist draw. Tourists come over here, people come in order to sort of get away from it all, and at any cost. It doesn't matter whether the groves, the trees of Vrindavan get cut down, the beautiful Parikramarg is turned into a circular road where people drive, where there's no longer any greenery or that sense of imagery to remind us what Vrindavan used to be even 20, 30 years ago. It's something that really invokes a passion. I said love-hate relationship. It invokes that type of very, very strong reaction, that same type of somehow or another insatiable and blinding greed, although certainly India is not the only place where the greedy people are. They're all over the world, everywhere. But how that greed is there, that people in phenomenally opulent buildings can live and on the other side of the boundary wall in front of them, there can be shanties, poverty-stricken people, open sewage flowing on the streets, garbage littered everywhere. And as long as it's in my area, they just turn a blind eye to it. And exploiting the resources of this beautiful country, just so long as you can enjoy. And I've seen, I saw the effect that it has. For instance, Govinda Maharaj more or less lived in India from 1976 till around 1996 for 20 years. And I saw the influence that it had on him. On one side, his very, very strong attachment to the Dham. On the other side, the westernization of the general Indian populace and what they were doing both to the Dham and to the rest of India, and how they were making, in one sense, fools of themselves instead of exporting their culture and being Krishna conscious and trying to make the whole world Krishna conscious. Their real effort was to just monkey whatever the Westerners were doing, the clothes they wear, the movies they watched, the way they spoke, the way they dressed, their lifestyle, haircut, everything. Even though within their hearts, actually, Krishna consciousness is so easily woken up, so easily aroused. And even now that's there. Anywhere I go, if I stop, either people will approach me, or if I talk to anyone, immediately topics of being Krishna conscious and what Krishna consciousness is and why I'm like that and why I'm this, immediately around. And they're naturally there. It's right under the surface. But just because it's under the surface doesn't mean that it's not covered. And it's really covered, well covered. And that's the problem. And I see myself when I come and I see the type of buildings, beautiful edifices that were constructed here and now, what they do, it brings out a resentment. They could do so much more or take care of their beautiful monuments that are by the tens and tens of thousands, but they just allow to crumble and decay. I was actually reading a article, BBC article. It was very interesting that it was a discussion on why England has to give aid to the poor of India. On one side, England is in a depression, not a recession, but a depression. It has people living on the streets and it can't feed its own. And they're arguing, but India has a 10% economic growth forecast for this year. Why does India not feed its poor people? Why does England or the rest of the world have to feed the poor of India? And of course the answer was, because the wealth isn't distributed, because on one side there's phenomenal wealth in India, and on the other side there's phenomenal poverty. That was the observation of my cousin when he came. He saw what a great disparity there was in between the way people were living, how there was such poverty and wealth side by side, and he saw that there was a real exploitation and an imbalance in the wealth, much more pronounced than, for instance, in the wealth, although obviously it's also there. So, yes, it's a love-hate relationship. But I'll close with a little conversation that I had with Govinda Maharaj about this, because we have this discussion often. And he said, but you know, I just brought some of my devotees in the fall to India, to Vrindavan, and However, as different as Vrindavan is from when we first came, when it really reminded us of the Vrindavan that we read about in Krishna book, the atmosphere of Vrindavan remains unchanged, and the people who, devotees who come here, they're as touched and impressed by the atmosphere of Vrindavan as we were when we first came. And that was conciliatory, it was reassuring in that sense, and I hope it remains like that, but I can't help but express that same type of feeling that I know many other devotees also feel, where they come to Mother India and at the same time see and feel these two drastically different types of things. The wonder that was India, as Basham wrote in his books, and the unfortunate direction in which India is going at the present time. Hare Krishna.